Hello and welcome to On the Record with White and Case, the podcast about the fast-paced and dynamic world of big law. Whether you're considering a career in big law, studying at law school, or already one of us, this podcast is for you. I'm Jane Kennedy, part of the firm's graduate recruiting team. Today I'm honoured to shine a light upon an inspiring force for justice within the legal realm, the Racial Justice Task Force of White and Case. In recent years, the urgency to address systemic racism and promote inclusivity has become an undeniable call to action. Law firms across the globe are stepping up to the challenge, and White and Case has emerged as a trailblazer in this regard. I want to introduce you to two of our co-chairs of our Racial Justice Task Force, Dana Foster, an antitrust partner based in our Washington DC office, and Gina Chiappetta, an antitrust associate based in our New York office. Dana, Gina, welcome.
Thank you, Jane.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for joining us today. Before we dive into these transformative initiatives and groundbreaking cases that you have been involved in, can you please tell our listeners a little bit about yourselves and your legal journey so far?
So my journey is a little bit circuitous. I was in the Navy for 6 years between high school and college. I traveled a few different places for that. I was in college at UVA for 4 years and then UVA Law. And I never thought I was going to be at a firm, but I actually met an M&A partner here in New York during OGIs that I really connected with, and then decided to start my career here at White & Case, actually in the New York office. And I was here for 2 years before transferring down to Washington. And I still thought I wasn't going to be here very long. And then now it's been, over 20, now it's been 22 years now, almost 23 years since I summered. So I do antitrust litigation. I've done other types of litigation throughout my career.
Wow, that's incredible.
I would say my journey was a little bit more ordinary, I guess. I went to law school directly after college. I always knew I wanted to go to law school, but I didn't really have a particular direction in mind. Didn't know if I wanted to work at a firm, what type of law I wanted to do. And I participated in on-campus interviews at Fordham and ended up really liking the people at White & Case. That is really what stood out to me. Ended up being assigned an antitrust trial as my first assignment at White & Case. And again, just like the people in the group and like the work I was doing, and ended up in the antitrust group, fell into it and have enjoyed it for the past 7 or so years that I've been in the group.
That's excellent. And it was the antitrust group that formed the Racial Justice Task Force.
That's right. And, it was the summer of 2020, these high profile killings by police, and people pretended to be the police during that summer. And COVID, people were, sort of at home a lot. It started, a few of the partners in the antitrust group decided that we could do more. White & Case is really known for doing a lot of pro bono. I know the founders, Mr. White and Mr. Case, did pro bono back many, many years ago. And I've been doing pro bono my entire career at White & Case. And so pro bono has always been like an important part of my practice. And then in the summer of 2020, me and Mark Gidley, the chair of the global chair of the antitrust group, I think I'm saying that right, and then a counsel in that office, Charles Moore, we decided we could do more. We could do more as a group. We could do more as a firm, specifically focused on criminal justice and racial justice. And so although it started as an idea among the three of us more senior folks, it quickly we didn't want it to be top down. We didn't want it to be the three of us making decisions of what we were going to do. We decided from the very beginning that we wanted it to be associate driven, and particularly more junior attorneys driven. And so we started sending out some emails and we started having some meetings, and it has just skyrocketed the interest. The different projects and everything like that. And of course, Gina was on board right from the beginning.
Is that how you got involved as well, Gina? How did you, hear about this? Was it through conversations with Dana, or how did that come about?
I think it was right after the Racial Justice Task Force was formed. Dana had sent an email to the entire antitrust group, sort of trying to get a kickoff meeting on the calendar where everyone could show up and give ideas about what the Racial Justice Task Force could do. And I had just participated in a wrongful conviction case. And It was a really great experience. We were able to get our client out of jail on a finding of actual innocence, and it just really sparked a lot of inspiration, I guess, in me and a lot of the colleagues who worked on that case. And just having the firm be open to, you know, getting clients who deserve our help in all these different ways, not just through partner organizations, I thought was maybe an important thing for the task force to hear about. So I spoke up at the meeting, and pretty much right after, Dana asked me if I wanted to be a co-chair.
I think that's what happened. But it's those types of things that we were trying to key in on when Mark and Charles and I were talking about how we have these brilliant attorneys that are doing very sophisticated legal work and solving problems for our clients all over the world that are oftentimes seem intractable. But we're living in the United States of America in 2020 where we have these intractable problems that are seemingly intractable problems that we could be doing more for on and working on. I always thought it was an obligation that we had to use some of this brain power, use some of the passion that we have for the law and for getting things right, which I think is a really unique Whiting case trait. To do more in the criminal justice space, criminal justice education, and economic empowerment, which is what we do.
And these are the main goals of the racial justice task force.
That's right. We thought that we should have these three sort of main pillars of things. Criminal justice, certainly. Gina's talked about it a little bit. That's definitely more of a litigator thing, I think. Right. And I think that's we were really and obviously the firm has done a lot about that in the past, and we thought we could do more there. Education is not something that I had been involved in that much before, but that's certainly something that everybody can do. And with economic empowerment, as far as giving African-American entrepreneurs and other folks, not just entrepreneurs, but business owners, the tools that they need, the legal tools that they need to thrive. And we thought that those are the three large areas we could focus on.
Great. And just to dive a little bit deeper into that then, Dana, in terms of the types of projects that you're involved in, obviously, that match with those pillars, I know that the Racial Justice Task Force is very involved with the Second Look project.
Right.
Can you both tell us a little bit more about that specific project?
Yeah, I can start that with a little bit. And that the Second Look project and that with the cases that we're doing there is the prototypical example of what the Racial Justice Task Force is about. That started in 2021, so after about 6 or 8 months after we started, a third-year associate, antitrust associate, Ashley Stoner in D.C., had a friend who she graduated law school with. She took crim law within law school as a 1L, who was working for this organization in D.C., and her friend had reached out to Ashley saying, there's this law in D.C. that allows individuals who were convicted of crimes before the age, at the time when it was first started, it was before the age of 18. And in the spring of 2021, they expanded the law to cover folks who were incarcerated up to the age of 25 or under the age of 25. So that there was going to be a much larger population of individuals who would be eligible under this law if they were convicted at this age, if they had served at least 15 years of their sentence, and they basically had a pretty clean disciplinary record while they were in prison, they could move the court to get resentenced and released. This law was specifically designed to fight the tough-on-crime laws from the 90s and early aughts where individuals, in particular African-American men, would get these incredibly lengthy prison sentences, oftentimes double the sentence that they would get if they were white. And now they're just languishing in prison, and now they're in their 40s or 50s. They're what I think the Second Look Project refers to as unnecessarily incarcerated. Like, there's no reason for these individuals who bear very little or no resemblance to the individuals that they were when they were 18 or 19 when the crimes were committed. And we could do that. And almost immediately, we had like 40 attorneys sign up to do it and seven cases right away. And now we've already gotten five individuals home. We've brought five people home from prison, five people who had no reasonable hope of ever getting out, and that spent more than half their life in prison, and now they're home with their families, it's an incredible thing. We're still litigating these cases, and Gina can talk about how we've been able to even expand upon that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the work in D.C. is fantastic, but I think there's states all around the country where, children, right, committed crimes and are in prison for most or all of their life. And so we thought we could look into similar organizations outside of DC to see if we could expand the work in this area. So I was able to find an organization called the Decarceration Initiative, and it's started by the Maryland Public Defender's Office. And they're doing very similar work in as we're doing with the Second Look Project in D.C. The difference being in Maryland, the relevant statute is only applicable to people who were convicted for crimes committed under the age of 18. So these are minors across the board who committed a crime and then are in jail for these incredibly long sentences. And so we have three clients currently who we're working on motions to reduce their sentence. And something I think is interesting, it's not just the length of the sentence, right? Even if these individuals are able to get out, right? They get paroled or, you know, they're out of prison. There's still really harsh penalties, right? So there could be periods of supervision where, you know, someone's being supervised or under parole for 15 years and they have to pay a fee every single month to be supervised. And these are people who obviously their employment prospects are incredibly diminished because they spent all this time in prison. They have a record. They had limited access to education. The odds are stacked against them already, and then they're being asked to pay money for 15 years already in difficult circumstances. So we have an opportunity not just to get people home, but also to improve their circumstances right when they get home, right? Shorten their periods of supervision and save them potentially thousands of dollars. So the impact goes beyond just simple, are they in prison or out of prison? It's also just what are they facing when they're out? So it's a really great opportunity to make an impact, and I think just a lot of Whiten Case attorneys have signed up and are really enthusiastic about these projects.
So many attorneys. Awesome. That's one of the things that's really great about this, because these cases, the Second Look ones are in D.C., the cases that Gina is supervising are in Maryland. But you don't have to be in either of those places. You don't have to be barred in those jurisdictions to work on them. So we've got people in Boston and Miami, here in New York, in Silicon Valley, L.A., all over, Houston, all of our – across the network, we have attorneys that are working on these projects, and they've been incredibly popular. And I will tell you that it's been some of the most meaningful work that these attorneys have ever done. And, on a couple of the cases that I've worked on, I've gotten to meet these individuals at the airport when they come home from prison. And it's an incredible thing.
That all sounds absolutely brilliant, and I'm glad that it's not a situation of, you know, case closed when they're coming out of prison. It's almost like that rehabilitative element after they're released as well, yeah, with compensation being obtained as well as, you know, eliminating these barriers into reentry of society in general, which is absolutely brilliant. I know that there's other elements that you've been working on and
right,
talking about that kind of elimination of the barriers. We've also got the case closed projects,
yeah,
that are taking place.
That's right. So that's, again, associate driven. There were two associates here in the New York office. This actually started, interestingly, that actually started because in, I think it was 2021, New York decriminalized marijuana. So we had some associates who thought these individuals who have convictions for marijuana possession, they probably should get there has to be a way to get their records expunged or sealed. So they started researching that and looking into helping with that. And during their research, they learned that actually, with marijuana being decriminalized, a lot of the criminal records associated with marijuana possession were going to be automatically sealed. But the Legal Aid Society, which is an organization we've partnered with over many years and is a very close organization to Whiten Case, they had a project where they were working with individuals who did have old criminal records, not just for marijuana possession or drug possession, but old criminal records. There's a statute in New York where you can apply to get your record sealed under certain circumstances that are 10 or 15 or 20 years old. And again, I think these are things that people take for granted, certainly I take for granted, not having a criminal record, and the barriers to better education opportunities, better housing opportunities, better job, better employment opportunities. In so many ways, having to check a box, having to explain that you've got this criminal conviction, that you were a felon or something, or even a serious misdemeanor from 15 years ago, can hamper your life. That can hamper your life. There's barriers in your life that you can't overcome. It's essentially a civil life sentence. These are convictions that, you know, the individual served the time if there was some, paid a fine if there was one.
Really minor offenses, right? These are nonviolent offenses. And in order to be eligible for this relief, you have to have a period of, I think it's 10 years,
right,
where you have not had another offense. So these are people who made a mistake, changed their life, put in the work, and are doing really well and still facing barriers from a 10-plus-year-old mistake.
Right. So, I mean, one example is an individual couldn't get housing, experiencing homelessness for a while, moved in with his mom, but then his mom got booted from her apartment because he was a felon living in her house. The barriers are real. And so they started looking into this project. They realized legal aid does this. They screen clients for you. They connect you with the clients. They give you the rap sheet, and it's easy or lighter lift to get these applications filed, identifying the courts they need to be filed in and filing them.
What I should say, though, is easy for us, not necessarily for the people who need relief, because there's often a lot of confusing questions about what's the correct court to file in, you know, which judge do I have to be in front of, all of those things,
right,
that we can figure out with our resources, but that can be incredibly challenging for the people who are eligible for this relief and don't have lawyers.
Right.
It's trying to navigate New York jurisdictional rules as a layperson who doesn't have any experience in law is hard. Sometimes it's hard for us.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, a light lift for people doing pro bono work, and can be, you know, a small number of hours to make a big impact, but really difficult for the people who need this help.
So we've started doing a bunch of these cases. Again, we have these incredible individuals here in New York. We started doing these cases, two or three associates, maybe a partner supervisor, individuals all over the country doing them, because you don't need to be barred in New York. You need to have a New York barred attorney file it, but we've got lots of those. So that's not a problem. And we've been doing those since 2021. So a couple of stats here. We just won our 15th case.
Thank
you. So 15 individuals who's now don't have a check a box. If they're asked, they don't have to say they have a criminal record, which is awesome. These are also cases that have been very, very popular with our corporate clients. We have rolled these out to our corporate clients. Again, our corporate clients are in-house attorneys. They don't have the expertise, the resources, often the time to do pro bono, even though they really want to do pro bono. And so we provide this infrastructure for in-house attorneys to work on a team and do these cases, talk to clients, draft an affidavit, help with the application, and then be part of the team that gets the success. And it's great for them because they've got supervision of Whiting case attorneys. Take care of their, you know, day job and they don't have time to commit to things, that's okay. We've got the other attorneys in place to do that. And then they get to do real work for actual clients. These are like real people. You get their story, you talk to them, and then you realize how big of an impact you can make. And so this has been hugely successful on some of the firm's biggest client with some of the firm's biggest clients.
And like you said at the beginning, Dana, this, you know, started off as, you know, a kind of a call to action, and
right,
now we have what sounds like hundreds of our attorneys working on these are absolutely amazing cases.
That's a great point. We have over 160 members of the task force. We have way more than that that are working on our cases right now.
That's absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
In terms of the, you know, the legal community, because you said that you've worked with other corporate partners,
right,
on this. How do you think that the Racial Justice Task Force has been received just within the larger legal community?
I think it's been a huge success with everyone who has heard about it, who wants to know more about it. I know for me, one data point is I do a lot of recruiting at my alma mater, and law students, that's one of the things they want to, they're very interested in. They see it on our website. They see it on my bio on the website, and they want to know more about what we're doing. And it's been a huge recruiting tool, but also clients, they really there is a passion among in-house attorneys to do pro bono, and they just can't do it. I mean, all attorneys or most attorneys have understand that they have an obligation to do pro bono. But when you go in-house, there's really no opportunities to do it. Like, there's not an infrastructure in place to do this work. In-house attorneys don't have malpractice insurance. Because they don't ever represent clients, right? They're just in-house at their own company. And so we have all of that available. And when they find out not only that they can partner with us, but that it's a relatively easy lift for them, and they can work on real cases. They can, if they want to go argue something, they can do that. If they want to draft a pleading, they can do that. But they don't have the pressure that, oh my gosh, I'm the one responsible for doing it. So it's a huge thing, and I think it's been the reception among everybody that's heard about it, I think it's been fantastic.
And I think it's really important too when we talk about the task force, not just the work that we do, but the opportunities that we're providing for junior attorneys, I think is really important.
That's a good point.
Because we're not just saying, hey, you have an opportunity to work on pro bono cases. You have an opportunity to bring projects to this firm, to run them. We've had junior associates running these projects, supervising 15 teams,
yeah,
right? And really showing their leadership skills, building their management skills, client development skills, right? That we're going to partner organizations and pitching ourselves as a partner.
I mean,
this is really incredible development experience. This isn't, oh, hey, we have a pro bono team and we have all these great projects that you can participate in as a lawyer. We're also giving, I think, junior attorneys unprecedented autonomy in their career to say, hey, I think this is a really awesome partnership we can pursue.
Right.
Let's go for it, right? This is your opportunity to actually do something incredibly meaningful from a career development perspective as well, which I think is a unique offering of our firm, and I think is recognized by, you know, our first-year associates when they come into the firm as an exciting opportunity, recognized when we're recruiting. And I just think really great for us that we are allowing this sort of, you know, we're allowing voices to be heard about what we can be doing better, how we can be doing it better, with who. I mean, I haven't heard any other law firms doing something similar. I really think it's something unique that White & Case is doing.
That's a good point.
That's brilliant. And in terms of, you were speaking about involvement in junior associates, can summer associates get involved? Can, you know, and people at different stages of their careers?
I mean, absolutely. So we have, not just summer associates, right? Like, law students with our externship programs are coming to the firm, and they are bringing projects to this firm, right? As law students, they are telling us what we can do better, right? So this is truly something that people at every level can get involved in. We have non-attorneys, we have practice assistants, we have business development folks who are participating in the task force. I mean, it's really not lawyers only, litigators only, pro bono enthusiasts only. It's really just anyone who has a good idea can make a really huge impact. So certainly summer associates, we make a huge effort to get them involved in our ongoing pro bono projects, have them attend our racial justice task force meetings so that they can get an idea of what we do. But also every semester we have two law student externs from Howard and from Southern who come here and bring brilliant ideas and brilliant projects.
We started the externship program. We decided that, obviously, we started with Howard University School of Law, and we thought, what about if we could get a law student, a 2L or a 3L, to come and be an extern, earn academic credit, but only work on pro bono cases. And that was something that we had never done before. I still haven't heard of any other firm doing it. And the firm was very much behind it. They were very supportive of it. And that has been hugely successful. So we started that in 2021. And so we get an extern in the fall semester and the spring semester. They come, they work on only pro bono cases. They work on a lot of task force cases, but also other types of pro bono. We had the big Ferguson, Missouri debtor prison case. They worked on that case. They worked on other bigger cases that we've done in the past. And then they work on a lot of task force cases. And they work on they work with me specifically to find a new project for the task force. We didn't stop there. We said, what other HBCU law schools could we look at? We have a corporate client who has a very close relationship with Southern University Law Center in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Obviously, we don't have any attorneys in Louisiana or really any attorneys barred in Louisiana. I think we have maybe one or two. But we have this corporate client contact that talked about how great that school was. And so we reached out to them. And again, this was in 2022. So I think people were still pretty remote working, or a lot of people were remote anyway. So that it made sense that we could do it and we could make it a remote externship. And now we're on our fourth Southern extern. And our Southern extern from last spring, I think that's right. She found a project with the ACLU of Louisiana called the Justice Lab, where the ACLU of Louisiana partners with law firms outside of the state of Louisiana to bring civil rights actions, Section 1983 cases against police officers and police departments within the state. The civil rights bar in Louisiana is very shallow. Because firms don't like to do it because they're worried about the client blowback of representing individuals suing the police. They don't want to be seen as either pro-criminal or anti-police. So firms in Louisiana don't do this type of work. So if they can partner with firms outside the state that don't have to worry about that, and these are in federal court, they design this whole program. They're co-counsel with you, and we started talking about a potential case, and now we're litigating a case in federal court, the Eastern District of Louisiana, on behalf of an individual whose dad was killed by police right outside of New Orleans. We brought Section 1983 case claims against the police officers who did the shooting, against their supervisors, and now we've been litigating that case for over a year. We have a big team. We have attorneys that are working on this case in D.C., and in Silicon Valley and here in New York, so it's a great case. We have done some Section 1983 cases before, but this is one for the task force. And again, it's something where we have a little bit of Section 1983 experience. We have a lot of litigation experience. We don't have a lot of experience in Louisiana, but we're stretching ourselves to do this work and on behalf of an amazing client.
With all of this work that you have kindly shared with us, it sounds absolutely incredible. But I want to take it back to your day-to-day work as antitrust lawyers. That's how do you balance that work with all of these amazing projects that you're involved in?
I'll say I think there's a challenge in balancing your work no matter what type of work you're doing, right? If you have four antitrust cases happening at the same time, it's going to be a challenge to balance everything. So my strategy is to do nothing different, right? Like every pro bono case that I have, I feel like is as important as the, antitrust work that we do or other type of work that we do. I think we have amazing respect in this firm for the pro bono work that we do. It's not considered second tier. So I think we have a lot of, up-down support for the pro bono work that we do. And if I say I have a deadline in my pro bono case, that's taken very seriously. I have to go to a hearing on my pro bono case. We get coverage on my antitrust matters for anything that I need to be doing on those cases. And people will step up and help out on the antitrust case so that I can focus on the hearing, right? I think my colleagues at my level, below my level, above my level, all have an attitude that they need to support the pro bono work that we're all doing, not just me, obviously, but that everyone's doing. So we just step up for each other when we need to. But I really just feel like it's a time management problem across the board, right? There's no special problem for the pro bono cases.
I think that's very well put, because you can't look at it like that. You can't look at it like extra, right? This is part of what we do. And just like any other case. So it's not like I'm going to clock out of my billable work at X time and then if I've got some time at the end of the day or at the beginning of the day to do pro bono. You can't look at it like that. And I don't think we look at it like that. And I don't think Whiting Case looks like that at all. It's these are other cases that we're doing. If you take a pro bono case, if you're working on a matter, if you're working for – even if it's a research project, it has to be this is my work. And Gina's exactly right. We all have to deal with time management issues. And it's definitely for me, when I was a first-year associate, second-year associate, it was a shock that it was so much, there was so much to do and how am I going to fit it all in? But you get those time management skills. And I think you're right, Gina, people pitch in, they understand. And we build out these great teams, and we have so many people that really want to do this work that it makes it a lot easier.
Great. So not a separate passion project, like you said. It's that integrated piece.
Right. And really, especially when you're a junior attorney, when you start thinking about it like that, you'll never get into a place where you say, I have to stop doing X or Y, or you start neglecting something, whether it's billable or not. That's one thing. And the second thing is, when you start looking at it as part of your practice, overall practice, then you can really start seeing the benefits of doing these pro bono cases as a junior attorney, because you're really building these skills. Gina's talked about it a lot, about the management skills, about the BD skills, stand up in court things if you're a litigator, client stuff, client development things if you're not a litigator. Like, these are real skills that you can develop. And once you start seeing it like that, then it's never going to be billable is the main course and pro bono is the, you know, a side dish or the dessert or something like that.
Excellent. I very much appreciate you both taking the time to meet with me today to discuss all the incredible projects that the Racial Justice Task Force is involved in and why it's at the forefront of driving tangible and real change to society at large. So thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you.
You can learn more about our work, our people, and the opportunities we offer at inside.whitecase.com and on our social media channels. Find us on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram at Whitecase. On the Record is for you, our listeners, so we want to hear from you. Email your thoughts, questions, and topic ideas to us at usgradrecruiting@whitecase.com. Please subscribe in your favourite podcast app so you don't miss out on more episodes. Thanks for listening.